Welcome to the Leadership Caffeine Podcast, where your host, Art Petty, connects you with the people passionate about supporting your professional development and helping you raise the performance bar for yourself and your organization. From frontline leaders to CEOs to management authors, educators, and visionaries, Art is talking to people who are excited about sharing their big ideas and changing the world. Whether you are listening on the run, on the road, or at your desk, we're glad you're tuned in for this episode of the Leadership Caffeine Podcast.
Gary Morton, welcome to the Management Excellence blog and the Leadership Caffeine Podcast. It is truly an honor to have you here. So how are you today?
I'm doing great, Art, and thank you for having me on this podcast.
It's a pleasure. So I have first a statement. I do have to thank you for your service in defense of our country. I and we as citizens can't say that enough. So again, I mean it. I'm honored to have you here and so appreciative of you and all of those who put themselves in harm's way to defend our countries, no matter what era or generation they're from. Thank you, sir.
Well, you're absolutely welcome.
And the next one is one that just goes back to maybe childhood fantasies of sorts. What's it like to be a tank commander? You've got to share that with us before we dive into your great book.
You know, it's an amazing thing. You know, for me, it was something I wanted to do for a long time since I was a child. And a tank is a very interesting piece of machinery, you know, and the tanks that I had were 60 tons pieces of metal. You have four members of the crew, and there's a lot going on inside the tank. You know, I describe in the book, actually, and I think the movie Fury does a pretty good job of depicting that close-knit environment that you have inside the tank, and the fumes from the main gun going off and the sounds of the engine and the hydraulic whir of the hydraulic system charging and the turret moving. And there's just a lot of interesting things going on, but it's a very intimate environment. You have a helmet that you wear, and inside the helmet, you're talking on the tank's communication system, but also as the tank commander, you have the radio net for your platoon and or company and or battalion that you are also talking on. So you flip back and forth between those different nets, and when that main gun goes off, the percussion is just impressive. It's just a lot of force that is going, and you feel it in your chest and in your bones.
I can only imagine. And so, I mean, it must be an environment of extreme teaming internally. You really have to be in tune with each other and your tank crew, and then you've got this distributed teaming environment with all of the other members of the tank brigade, if that's the right term. So fascinating experience. Thank you for sharing that. So your book, Commanding Excellence, Inspiring Purpose, Passion, and Ingenuity Through Leadership That Matters. I mentioned in our pre-talk, I read a lot of business and leadership books. They're often not page-turners. Yours was a page-turner. I found myself drawn in to your two very unique stories and a bit of a comparison contrast. You've had the experience of serving under, working for two leaders that you described as extraordinary. So what, I mean, just at a high level, what was that like? Most of us only get that once in a lifetime or once in a career if we're lucky. You had two incredible experiences with great leaders.
Yeah, I did. And it was fabulous. It was, enriched my lives. In the long run, it enriched the lives of my family and people that I know. But, it was such a unique experience, to get that chance to be a part of one 10X, or in these cases, I mean, they were organizations that achieved what most considered impossible, can't be done. This National Training Center winning 9 out of 9 battles, the National Training Center was designed to make you fail. You would learn through failure, because it was intended to give the battalions and the task forces that went there such an intensive training experience that they couldn't possibly win, but they would learn so much because it'd be more intensive. And even though you're not bullets, real bullets are not flying, but the actual combat simulation would be more intensive than anything you'd be likely to experience in combat. So you were supposed to lose, and we won. Every single battle.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely incredible. Does that record still stand, by the way, 9-0, unparalleled?
Still stands. Never been done before, never been done since. And, you know, as I release the book and it's starting to make its way into the mindset, the officer corps, and within the Army, people recognize that name, Fred DiBella, and the responses are, oh, yeah, he's that legend. that task force that did that. Nobody, you can't do that, but they did.
So, you know, I don't have the benefit of extreme military experience. My wife's family, hardcore military, and again, that's why I'm so thankful for people who do serve. But as I was reading your description, particularly at the beginning, before those, as Fred's leadership began to assert and he began to voice, you know, commitment to winning, and there was some cynicism from different parts of the team. I could only think about different organizations that I've been a part of, or different strategic teams or project teams, where there's that same. There's just kind of they lack those three key ingredients you talk about: purpose, obsession, and ingenuity. But how does it begin to develop over time? That's what I was thinking about as I'm listening to that. How do people begin to believe? What was the process you guys went through?
You know, I think in both organizations, both the Armored Battalion and at Stryker, the leaders followed, you know, very different people, but they followed a similar path. You know, Fred came into that unit. It was the worst performing combat unit in the 4th Infantry, Mechanized Infantry Division, and we were bad. And he started to establish a rapport. Then he also, he was a believer in a very simple philosophy of being able to, of how you lead troops in combat. And that is you demonstrate tactical and technical proficiency and you take care of your soldiers. And to demonstrate that tactical and technical proficiency for him, part of it was demonstrating that he had the courage to do things that were outside of what the normal soldier would expect of their leader. And so he started that right away. He went to a gunnery exercise his very first day in command. And he hasn't been around tanks for probably 8-9 years. Mm-hmm. And to do well in a gunnery exercise is very difficult. I mean, the tank commander has a big role to play. They've got to sight the target. They've got to get the main gun slewed in the general direction of it. And you got to have this crew all acting together. So very difficult to do. The previous commander, and most commanders, you know, they don't go and even do a rundown tank table 8. Well, he did it. He did a run, and he scored a perfect score with his tank crew. So that started to establish this sense of, hey, this guy is good. And, you know, he gained some credibility. Then he continued to do things that would build that trust, build that respect, and so when he put out the 9-0 goal, there was a lot of skeptics because it was, you know, it's like, you know, imagine the last place team last year in the collegiate football league, you know, for the NCAA Division I A, and they get a new coach and he says, hey, we're going to win the national championship. Like, what? I mean, we couldn't beat anybody last year. Well, how are we going to win the national championship? And yet we did that. It's just amazing. So he builds that. The other thing that Fred, a number of things that he did. So he builds an understanding that he'll go out on a limb. And then he also built an understanding that he'll also let you go out on a limb, and he'll have your back.
Okay.
So, you know, one of the very first simulated battle exercises we were in was this place called Pinyon Canyon. We were fighting an opposing forces, which was just out of Fort Carson. It wasn't the NTC. I mean, this was long before the NTC. And we have one of our guys that starts putting up a smoke screen. And he does this in a certain way. And the brigade observer comes on the radio net and says, hey, we can't do this. And, you know, that smoke screen is obscuring the enemy's view. I'm like, well, that's the intention of it. But Fred backs it up 1,000%. Says, under no circumstances will you stop delivering smoke. And so he put his neck on the line because the brigade observer, most new commanders aren't going to contradict what the brigade observer says.
Sure.
And that builds this sense within the unit of, hey, this guy's got our back. you know, we can, he'll listen to, he'll let us do and experiment with different things. And then one of the unique aspects of this, and I think this is critical for people in any organization, and that those that are at the Fred DiBella level, if you will, he's a battalion commander, and a battalion is a part of a brigade, and there are typically three brigades in a division. So three battalions in a brigade, three brigades in a division.
Okay.
Well, his next level commanders gave him unwavering support for what he was doing. And that was very unique. Because if you go out with a 9-0 objective and, you know, you put combat proficiency as the number one thing, but you get a whole lot of interference from higher level headquarters or higher level leaders that say, well, you know, maybe that's not so important. It's difficult to build that obsession. He didn't have that.
Yeah.
He had unwavering support from the top.
So it's just so, it's a really great description of some of those behaviors and attributes so critical to create, maybe it's not the right term, but kind of this catalytic effect. And people begin to believe, and certainly in my experience, I've found that once that belief begins to kick in, the group becomes pretty powerful, and it sounds like that happened there. How did it start at Stryker with John Brown's leadership? I understand that he came into the role, and the company was relatively small, and of course, it didn't end up small, that's for sure. So how did John Brown get it going there?
Yeah, John, you know, he established his courage, if you will. For John, the courage piece was really his work ethic. I mean, nobody worked harder than this man. It's not possible. And it gained respect because you knew that the top leader was working as harder than anyone to drive the success of the organization. So he comes into Stryker, which was a small boutique medical device manufacturer out of Kalamazoo, Michigan, started by an orthopedic surgeon who was an inventor, creative guy, but really wasn't looking to build a multinational corporation. And his son is running it, and his son's got some ambition, and he's doing some good things, mm-hmm. but unfortunately he dies in a plane accident, the plane that he was piloting himself. And his whole family perishes, except for his wife and some friends perish. His children survive.
Mm-hmm.
The board does a search. They identify this guy, John Brown, who's leading a division of Bristol-Myers Squibb called WEC, and they bring him in and hire him. And, and he sets about doing what he does, working real hard. But for John, everything flows from the goal. And eventually they coalesce on 20%. We're going to grow 20% every year, every quarter of every year. And there's this mentality in the company to grow every month. And that starts to change things because he begins to put the pieces in place. He changes the number of people, starts to work on the philosophy. He's always working hard, always doing things to generate this 20% growth. One of the things that really was pivotal in opening the mindset within that little boutique medical device manufacturer was his very first significant acquisition, which was not significant in the realms of acquisitions, particularly in today's world. But he goes out and identifies some inventors that have a pretty neat hip design, a hip being an implantable hip. And he decides he wants to buy it. And the board initially is not very, they're not very impressed by this, but like DiBella, they hired this guy, John Brown, and they knew that they wanted to grow the company, and they agreed on this 20% goal, so they support him. And Stryker acquires this little company called Osteonics that has a unique hip design, and that grows over time to be the largest and most profitable division of the company. So it's those types of things that start to build this ethos, this idea of excellence, of growth and whatnot at Stryker, and it grows over time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's interesting within the company, if you knew people that were there when John first joined versus, say, 10 or 12 years later, which was when I joined, is they knew that he developed this reputation, this respect within the company, and he was, he's John Brown. And they said, well, I know him. I used to know him when he wasn't John Brown. You know, he was just this guy that we hired.
Right.
He was just John, But that was the kind of the transition that happens. And the respect that that guy earned, I put a little posting on LinkedIn just a few weeks ago of, you know, as myself getting a handshake with John. You know, I don't have that many followers on LinkedIn. I've got like 500 people or whatnot. But a whole bunch of old reps and employees. I mean, it's got 10,000 views and a whole bunch of likes and whatnot. And it's all out of respect for John.
Sure. Yeah. Amazing.
And right, the power. And the things that he did and the impact that he had on them personally.
So I have to ask a question here. I can imagine you're in the military and, you know, your defense of country, it's life or death, and there's just this mission critical, the criticality to everything that you're doing. I can see at least why that is a great petri dish for this incredible high performance to emerge, albeit it takes a unique person and the right characteristics and the right behaviors. Now, if we jump over to the commercial side, where I've spent my 30 years and have had a wonderful, wonderful career, a chance to turn around businesses, grow companies into market leaders, I've had some wonderful success, some really outstanding failures, too, that I managed to learn from along the way. Yet the notion of growth, I can imagine myself being on the receiving end of we're going to grow 20%. That's not a strategy. And in fact, I've heard whether it's we're going to be the $100 million company in 5 years or so forth and so on. That number issue just doesn't have the same, in my mind, compelling purpose that I can develop an obsession for that I might in the military. So how did John transcend that? Because numbers are numbers. I mean, how did that environment just become obsessed with that performance?
Yeah, that's a great question, because the way that he did it was allow you to do what you do best and allow you to develop your own strategy and your own approach. Mm-hmm. And when I say you, I mean primarily the division leaders,
right,
divisional leaders to generating the growth. And he gave you a lot, I mean, more autonomy than you would ever guess. So on the one hand, I agree that both these organizations' objectives, you know, 9-0, there's a tie to winning the battles, and right, you know, that allows you to win the war. 20% doesn't sound particularly inspirational. yet the things that the organization accomplished in the process of delivering that 20% really profoundly changed the way healthcare is delivered in a number of places and a lot of things around the world, and changed a lot of employees' lives. Mm-hmm. So, and John didn't have to have the manner in which it was achieved be dictated by him. Mm-hmm. He was very unusual in that regard. I mean, we had this rigorous philosophy of focus through decentralization, and you got to run your own ship. You know, I started the EMS business, and we were far removed from orthopedic implants or powered surgical instruments. We were in the pre-hospital market. We developed our own brand, our own brand identity, our own methodology. I mean, what was constant about it, if there was a constant, and there was, what was constant about Stryker was this very simple philosophy of business. You know, we invent great products that are best in class. We make them of super high quality and deliver them on time. And we sell them nine times out of 10 through the best direct sales force in that particular market. And that was it.
So that's is that in essence John's playbook there? I know you have the Silver Lions. And notice I said Silver Lions, not Silver Linings playbook.
So that was good.
So was that Stryker's playbook effectively?
It had a similar effect, yes. Mm-hmm. You know, it was a straightforward approach to running your business.
So tell us a little bit about the Silver Lions playbook, which, as you describe it, it had really six core plays in it for the military.
Yeah, you know, this is one that I, as I talk with military and folks in the military circles, I try to make sure that I explain correctly. Because there's a lot of confusion out there that it's the plays themselves. You know, okay, the guard goes off tackle here, and you pitch the ball out to them. You know, if you football analogy type of thing, and that was the key to success. It wasn't. I mean, the plays they worked for us because they worked for us. The playbook, what it was a brilliant idea to simplify the process of taking a higher level mission and translating that into how you're going to execute your mission in this particular battle. So it provides a template for that. And we developed our template to fit our strengths, our weaknesses, our commanders, our learning, and that is the key to the playbook. It became an extension of our collective consciousness within that task force. And it greatly simplified a lot of complex tasks. What the Army was teaching at the time, when you get an order from higher headquarters, was a 9-step planning process. And this was, it was really well done. I mean, it's a case study in how to plan an operation. The problem is it had an Achilles heel. It takes a lot of time. And most battalions, most task forces at the National Training Center were spending the vast majority of the time between receipt of mission and launch, going across the LD or line of departure, so essentially the launch of that mission, mm-hmm. developing the perfect plan. And they had some really brilliant plans. But they took all the time away from the trigger pullers to develop the plan. And we just inverted that. And the playbook was a key element to allow us to do that. So only a third of the time would be taken at the battalion headquarters level. And the rest of it would be back to the companies, platoons, and squads, so they could get ready to do what they needed to do in that upcoming battle.
Yeah, that's a great description. I do a lot of work on strategy development and strategy execution work with organizations, and I find your playbook there a really powerful model or tool that organizations could adopt. Certainly, the concept of it could be applied in the commercial environment there. I think that one has legs beyond what you accomplished with your task force. I think it has legs in the commercial sector in a big way.
Oh, Art, I couldn't agree more. I mean, in a sense, the playbook allowed a creation of what John Brown did at Stryker. Mm-hmm. It allowed the smaller unit leaders, or in John's case, the divisions, to go and run their own ship, to do what they needed to do to fight their battles, whether they were battles on the battlefield or battles in the marketplace.
Right, right, yeah. No, so many great valid lessons there for all of us. So how did serving under Fred, how did that begin to mold you as a leader? This is earlier in your life, earlier in your career, of course. How did that begin to mold you as a leader?
Well, you know, I graduated from West Point. I was in the top 5%. I was actually 7th in my class when I graduated. So I'd learned a lot there and had a lot of great people around. And I'd seen folks lead in different ways. Mm-hmm. And, you know, developed my own leadership style to some degree. And then seeing Fred in my first unit to have such a powerful example of exceptional leadership was just transformational. He became a personal mentor for me, but even if I hadn't had that personal relationship, just being able to absorb through osmosis the things that he was doing and the way that he approached things. And I'm not the same person as Fred, but the concepts and the heart underlying how he led soldiers was just tremendous, and it influenced me in a profound way.
And so you have this, I mean, what an incredible set of life experiences from, West Point to serving under Fred. And now you transition, you go into the commercial sector and you're under John. How did the experience with John continue to mold you as a leader? What was additive in that situation? What else did you learn?
Yeah, I think... you know, I knew I'd gone to West Point. I knew a lot about the military and whatnot, and I go into industry. Mm-hmm. And I interviewed at 13 different companies, all great firms. And I, I'd had initial interviews, and then I went out to visit, I think, about 10 of them. And of all of the interviews, so here's a guy coming out of the military, was top in his class, he's got essentially an MBA, so you know, maybe probably want to hire him. And of all the places I went, Stryker was the one place that had a clear definition of what I was going to do from day one. And they were going to give me the project management responsibility for a division's most significant new product project. Mm-hmm. Like, well, wow, how could I turn that down? You know, on one hand, people might say, well, I'm not ready. I'm afraid to do that, whatnot. I was looking for that kind of opportunity. And, you know, John Brown, I interviewed with John, and it was, as I describe in the book as well, you know, my dad was an Air Force veteran. He went to college on the GI Bill, graduated from Purdue as an electrical engineer, and he joined the steel industry. And my dad worked hard. Not as hard as John Brown, but he worked really hard. And I saw him work so hard and not get a real return on that huge investment because he chose the wrong industry. So, you know, I see John, I see elements in him that sounded similar to Fred DiBella, and the industry was just one that, well, this isn't the steel industry. We've got opportunity here. This place has grown at 20% a year for 12 years, and I bet you it's going to continue that for a good period of time going forward. So I hope I'm answering your question there.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just, if you start with the premise that many of us don't end up working for two extraordinary leaders, you had that experience. I work with a great number of people that actually are motivated to become those types of effective, oftentimes servant leaders, because they never had the experience to be molded by someone, or they had the experience to come up under people that you and I might reasonably describe as less than effective leaders, and that's a polite... phrase there. So I'm just trying to get to the essence of how these people impacted you, because I have every belief that although, you know, they're remarkable and extraordinary, it had to carry on through the ranks, through your own leadership behaviors and attributes. I have no doubt that you had a significant effect on the people around you, and just trying to see how these guys molded you.
Yeah, well, like to think that I did have a huge effect on a lot of people's lives. And you know, one of the ways that they molded me was it inspired me to write this book, because I agree. I talk to so many people, and they're not engaged. They're not happy with their work, or they're not happy with the team that they work for, or their boss. And I just want more great leadership out there. Cause it's so transformational for people's lives, and there isn't that much great leadership. There's a lot of bad.
Yeah.
There's some good, mm-hmm. but great is pretty rare, and it doesn't have to be. You know, these things that Fred and John did are not complicated, and that's what I try to share in the book.
It's interesting. I wrote an article recently on the Management Excellence blog that said, "Hey, look." Great leadership is effectively a lot of common sense. And I got some pushback on that, and I suppose I oversimplified it. Yet you can ask just about any person in any organization what constitutes an effective leader. Let's not use the term great. And they'll give you fundamentally the same answers. The reality is, though, even though it's kind of commonsensical in terms of those things to do, respect, autonomy, many of the things that you're highlighting here, give great people a chance, you know, purpose, obsession, and, you know, and what have you, it's not commonplace. And that frustrates me no end. So that's kind of my own personal one-person mission to help change the world one individual at a time for the better, so that we can find some more Fred DiBellas, John Browns, and Gary Mortons out there. And that was a little bit of a commercial for what drives me, but you brought it out of me there, so thank you.
Well, that's good, Art. I mean, that will help. It'll help create more great leadership out there.
Hey, so
one of the keys is, and you know, Tim Cook and Steve Jobs before him talk about this at Apple, which mm-hmm. is it's the world's most valuable company. You think they've got to be doing some things right there. But they're really exceptional at figuring out what they're not going to do.
Oh, yeah.
And that is just key. I mean, this absolute clarity of purpose for Fred It defined what was important, what was most important, and what was unimportant. And in the Army, you've got a lot of people that are kind of looking at what you're doing, particularly when you're a commander, and they're making judgments. And if you're one of those people that want to have to please everyone, you're not likely to gain greatness because you can't please everyone. You know, 468 Armor was not great at close order parade drill. That was not going to let us win.
Didn't sound like
cause
they
us
cared.
To win at the National Training Center.
Yeah, it didn't sound like they cared. They chose not to focus on that. And
we chose not to focus on it. And, right. You know, in business today, with all these different regulatory requirements and everything else that's out there, you've got to be very, if you want greatness, you have to be very deliberate about those things that you choose to be great at.
Gary, the other thing, get
in the middle, be average at those. You know, mm-hmm. if there's these 50 different regulatory requirements that aren't going to drive your fundamental core purpose, then you don't want some regulatory agency coming in and shutting you down. You can't do that. But you don't have to be great at it either. You know, just be average.
So let's drill into this clarity of purpose a little bit. In 100% of the circumstances where I show up to work with organizations that are either average in some case or not succeeding, or project teams that are flailing and failing, clarity of purpose is missing.
Yeah.
Why? You know, when I go out to organizations who are kind of drowning in their own, everybody's working hard, but they have too many initiatives chasing too few resources, and there's no clarity of purpose. There's no focus. Why do we miss this, and how do we get it back? How do we begin instilling that discipline in our organizations?
You know, it just seems so simple. Mm-hmm. And when you've watched it and you've been a part of it and then you've done it, it isn't difficult. But making that transition from, because I don't know, maybe I'm oversimplifying the American educational system or the way we approach things, but I'll just use an Army example, for example. The Army OER system, or Officer Efficiency Report System, was kind of required you to be great at everything to be below the zone or to advance as fast as you could in your career. Required you to be great at everything. You had to be a great staff officer, a great TAC at the military academy, a great commander. And when you got those opportunities to command, and so that mindset is out there. I have to be great at everything, and so many leaders, they try to do that and be great at everything, and have their organizations be great at everything. And what that creates is all of a sudden you don't have you lack that clarity of purpose. Mm-hmm. You've got to decide what you're not going to do great.
Yeah,
and it's hard for people because we've grown up thinking you got to do everything
right,
great.
Right. You know, and I love that. So you describe maybe you're oversimplifying. It comes back to my similar take in the leadership article. It is fairly, it's common sense. It's just not as commonplace as we would like it. So I have to ask, and you mentioned at some point in the book that over time organizations, teams might go from good to great and back to good again. You know, is that entropy setting in? The struggle to sustain greatness that's kind of like the consultant's search for the holy grail of business, right? They're all looking. What is it that allows one organization to sustain and consistently beat while others don't? Yet there seems to be this eventual return to good or less than good. What do we lose along the way that allows that to happen?
You know, I experienced that at Stryker as John retired and we went from great to good. Mm-hmm. And to me, we lost our purpose. Hmm. It was 20% growth. Mm-hmm. And that was it. And we'd gotten the company to be a fairly significant size. We got a new CEO. And, you know, all of a sudden it wasn't 20% growth. It was, well, we got a newfangled idea. And I think at the time it was, we're going to be the fastest growing, most admired medical device company in the world. Well, that sounds inspirational and aspirational, if you will. But mm-hmm. what does fastest growing mean?
Right.
So all of a sudden, instead of 1.2 times last year, simple. It's all these division presidents, everybody's starting to politic for their goal for next year, or and the next year after that, and the year after that. And it's how fast is our market growing? And it's not clear. There's not simple metrics for that out there and all these different markets that Stryker divisions are involved in. And so it became muddled, and you couldn't no longer the whole hierarchy that John had set up, the whole ethos inside that organization to achieve the 20% number became it was not understandable anymore. And as a result, what did we do? Well, the company became, it's still a good company. It's a very good company.
Sure.
But it's not delivering 20% earnings growth year after year, quarter after quarter. And it was difficult to watch that and to experience that happening.
Yeah.
So we lost our purpose. We redefined what we thought was what leadership thought was another purpose, but it lacked the cogency. And one of the things that was clear at Stryker is things were simple, but as an organization grows, the key is it's not simple to keep it so simple, because the tug of bureaucracy is always there.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to cut through all that red tape and all those well-intentioned people that are trying to put checks and balances in the system. And it all sounds good in the midst of a crisis, but 15 years later, you can have a system that doesn't work for anyone.
Yeah, so many object lessons in that as well. I'm as you're describing it, I'm thinking of organizations that I've watched in similar fashion go from great to good or less than good. And it's almost as the leader at that point in time, you just want to have a big sign that said, "Warning: you're inviting good to the party, and that's not great. Go back to the simplicity, or find the new simplicity." Things change, but something.
Yeah. Yeah. Like here's an example at Stryker. I remember when John had a key employee stock option program, and it was non-qualified stock options, so they're worth nothing on the day that people get them. They're only worth something if the stock price goes up. And so, they'd be granted in certain levels, and they'd be worth a certain amount of stock that somebody might control. Well, the company decided, and a lot of matter of fact, almost all companies have done this, because a lot of scrutiny has come down from the pundits, from the public, whatever, on stock options, and they became to be something that was bad. Oh, this is bad. These executives are getting something they shouldn't get. So it became acceptable, though, to do restricted stock units. And that was okay. Everyone thought, restricted stock units, because then they have the stock and it's more clear then. And they don't get as much. You don't give as much in restricted stock units. But it's not, it's no longer then only growth matters. Because, I got a restricted stock unit. Stock's trading at 50, and I got 50.
Right.
And it's worth 50, and I'm going to get that. Well, Stryker decided to do that, too, just like most companies did in that 2000. It was the post-Enron thing in that era. And they went away from stock options, which, even today, there's still this residual that's a bad thing, stock options, to restricted stock units. And, it was a combination of RSUs and stock options. And I remember at the time, John was retired, and I think, this is a big step in our path from great to average. Because now you don't have to grow to make these worth anything. You don't have to grow.
The policy shift seemed in alignment with the world at that point, yet it had the unintended effect of pushing it back. Yeah, a great example. Thank you for sharing that.
As an investor, if you could find those companies that are just doing stock options and not RSUs, buy them.
That's worth the price of admission to the podcast. Thank you.
There you go.
So a couple of kind of questions as we begin to wind down here. Younger generation, emerging leaders, the workplace is becoming younger, certainly more female, more colorful. Those are facts of demographics. What's your guidance for emerging leaders today in our organizations?
You know, I think it's a wonderful time for emerging leaders because a couple of thoughts there. One is because the old guard, if you will, the baby boomers, they're all retiring and they're leaving the workforce. So there's this vacuum that's being created that can be filled with folks that are much more tech savvy, that understand the mentality of the people that grew up in this newer age, and can figure out how to better influence, how to better lead those groups. But the principles, the fundamental principles, are the same. For leading human organizations, and I try to lay out three of those that help to deliver greatness in the book. You know, have a clear purpose. Have a clear purpose. Spread a desire to achieve that purpose throughout every person in the organization. Give them a sense that they matter, that what they do matters, that what they do will contribute to the achievement of this purpose. And then create an environment in which creativity can be unleashed at extraordinary levels. Because the workforce today is more creative, I believe, than the baby boomers. And if we can harness that and release that throughout organizations all over the country, it will be tremendous.
Just fabulous guidance. So in addition to your outstanding book, Commanding Excellence, what would be the one other book you might encourage these emerging leaders to read?
That is a good question.
Yeah, I didn't mean to put you on the spot, but I always like to hear what other people's reading. What book affected you the most and might be worthwhile at this point?
You know, there was a number in the military, but I'm going to confine it to a business book because I think in my business career, the one that provided a lot of clarity for me was Good to Great. There was a lot of similarities in the striker environment there. And matter of fact, a later Jim Collins book called Great by Choice highlights Stryker as one of the main companies that he looks at there. Although he never interviewed anybody in the company, never talked to John, he does a great job of depicting a good piece of what the Stryker environment was like.
Love the book. Didn't know he didn't interview them, which is interesting given that he's a researcher by background. But fabulous choices. It's interesting. One of the firms I'm working with right now, every employee upon joining gets a copy of Good to Great. So I think that's a fabulous recommendation. That there's some timeless benefit to that that book. So where can people get Commanding Excellence?
Well, it's available in bookstores all over the country, Barnes & Noble, and then, you know, of course, Amazon, BarnesandNoble.com, iBooks. There's a Kindle version out, and I'll have an audiobook version out here in the next month or so as well.
Are you reading the audiobook?
I am, okay. And I hope my voice is pleasing to people. People tell me that it is, so I think it affords me the opportunity to put emphasis on particular words and whatnot in it as well.
I think that will be fantastic. And where can people get you?
I'm on LinkedIn, I'm on Facebook, and there's a website, igarymorton.com.
Great. And are you out speaking and consulting or planning the next book? Where can we expect to see you, or what can we expect to see from you?
Well, right now I'm launching the book. I've got a couple of speeches that I've done, and I'm open to do more. I'm interested in those opportunities where folks really do have an organization that they want to do something great with. And I'd be all over that.
Great. And a last question, I promise. What did you learn writing the book?
You know, it was fabulous experience. It was a fabulous experience writing the book. I learned how what struck me most as I interviewed people from the Armor Battalion, and you know, I had talked to folks for Stryker over the 25-year career there, but you know, having that focus on the questions that would be pertinent for what I was discussing in the book. It was amazing how these two leaders had so deeply influenced so many lives.
Great reminder. Gary, thanks so much. Again, I'm honored to have had you here. Thrilled you shared some remarkable perspectives on commanding excellence. As I indicated earlier, I find the book fantastic. I don't often find books in the business and leadership category as page-turners. Yours is. I look forward to sharing it with my community for many years to come. Thank you.
Thank you, Art.
You've been listening to the Leadership Caffeine Podcast with your host, Art Petty. Check back frequently at artpetty.com for new episodes or for more information about programs to support your professional development.